From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 12 of NIH Research Radio with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfelt. Coming up on this edition of NIH Research Radio, quite an action-packed episode it is. I do hope you have some time to spend with us today. I had the opportunity to sit down with a scientist from the National Cancer Institute who's been with NIH for 50 years. Wally Akinso has a report about how research shows effective treatment of addiction saves money and reduces crime. Wally also has a report about a disease you may never have heard of and what one institute at the NIH is doing to change that. Matt Thornton will tell you about how early treatment can prevent lifelong breathing problems in premature babies, and then he'll share a story on an effective program geared at lowering the incidence of HIV/AIDS infection in Hispanic youths. There is an interesting study about the evolution of language and how a common ancestor of monkey and man may be the linchpin in the search for origins. Wally returns with a look at a study that shows children whose mothers smoke during pregnancy are more likely to have behavior problems at an early age. So, as you can hear, we've got a lot to do on this edition of NIH Research Radio, and we'll get started with a report about how you might be sacrificing lung function for that clean smell you get from an air freshener. That's straight ahead on NIH Research Radio. If you had the key to unlock the secrets of medical science, you'd use it,
wouldn't you?
At the NIH Clinical Center, many of our studies involve healthy volunteers who provide valuable insights in finding new ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat common and rare disorders.
Do you have the key?
Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Everyone enjoys fresh, clean-smelling air and sparkling, clean bathroom fixtures, but are we trading off proper lung function in the process? That's the question raised in a recently published study conducted by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, which showed that exposure to a chemical in many air fresheners, toilet bowl cleaners, mothballs, and other deodorizing products may lead to modest reductions in lung function. NIEHS researcher Dr. Stephanie London was lead investigator in the study. She said that even a small reduction in lung function may indicate some harm to the lungs, and she offered this advice to people, especially those who have children with asthma or other respiratory problems.
To the extent that someone is inclined to try to lower exposures whenever possible, especially people who have more sensitivity than others because of lung problems, they may wish to try to reduce their exposures to the extent possible.
The suspect chemical is a volatile organic compound known as 1,4-dichlorobenzene. Dr. London said researchers will take a closer look at the health effects of this compound.
It doesn't say very specifically that it's this compound per se. This compound is probably measured a little bit better than some of the other compounds, so it may be that's why it shows up. So we are interested in looking at whether this particular compound is responsible for the finding.
The study was published in the August 2006 edition of the journal Environmental Health Perspectives. One institute at the NIH has some ideas about how communities can lower their crime rate and save money by dealing effectively with addiction. Wally Akinso has that report.
A report from the National Institute on Drug Abuse showed that effective treatments of drug and addiction can save communities money and dramatically reduce crime. The report, called Principles of Drug Abuse Treatments for Criminal Justice Populations, outlines some proven components for successful treatment of drug abusers who have entered the criminal justice system, leading to lower rates of drug abuse and criminal activity. Untreated substance abuse adds significant costs to communities, including violence and property crimes, prison expenses, court and criminal costs, and child abuse and neglect, according to NIDA Director Dr. Nora Volkoff, who said the principles of drug abuse treatment are powerful and practical tools that will allow communities to choose between ongoing treatment and ongoing crime.
by providing data about how effective treatment is, I mean, it's one of those situations that is a win-win, because society wins in that you decrease crime, and the individual wins in that you provide them with help to overcome the disease of drug addiction. And everybody wins because you are saving dollars from the taxpayer.
Dr. Volkoff said that without proven treatment and therapeutic follow-up in a community setting, addicted offenders are at a higher risk of relapse despite a long period of forced sobriety. You can read this report on NIDA's website, www.drugabuse.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Preventing long-term breathing problems and potential brain injury in preemies is the subject of this report from our own Matt Thornton.
Two large multi-center studies supported by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute found that inhaled nitric oxide, or NO, helps prevent chronic lung disease in premature infants and, if used within 48 hours after birth, might also prevent brain injury in these tiny newborns. Dr. Mary Ann Berberich, scientific research group leader in the developmental biology of the lung and pediatric lung diseases at the NHLBI, talked about some of the findings.
The study was really looking for the efficacy of using NO treatment to decrease the risk of developing BPD and decrease the risk of death. So the endpoint was survival without BPD at 36 weeks post-menstrual age.
Bronchopulmonary dysplasia, or BPD, often occurs when premature birth apparently interrupts the normal development of the lung. The results of this study can be found in the July 27th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. For more information, visit www.nhlbi.nih.gov. From the National Institutes of Health, I'm Matt Thornton in Bethesda, Maryland.
When we return, I have the pleasure of spending some time with a National Cancer Institute scientist who's been with the NIH for 50 years. That's coming up on NIH Research Radio. A key to good health is eating healthy foods. So, when you're dashing around the supermarket, dash to the produce aisle for fresh fruits and vegetables. Dash to the dairy case for low-fat milk products. Dash to the foods that are lower in saturated fat, trans fat, cholesterol, sodium, and added sugars. Dash to the foods that have been proven in the fight against high blood pressure. For more information about the Dash Eating Plan, log on to www-plan.org. This message brought to you by the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm sitting in a conference room, and I have no idea where I'm at, other than the fact that I'm in Building 10 in the Clinical Center here on the campus of the National Institutes of Health. And I'm talking with somebody who's been here probably longer than this building has been here.
The Clinical Center was built in 1953, and I came here in 1956. I've been here 50 years.
July 1st, 1956, correct?
Indeed.
Let's put that in perspective, if you don't mind. Here are some of the news events from the days previous to your showing up at the NCI. June 23rd, 1956, Gamal Abdel Nasser becomes the second president of Egypt. June 29th, Marilyn Monroe marries playwright Arthur Miller. June 29th, President Dwight David Eisenhower signs the Federal Aid Highway Act, creating the interstate highway system. And on July 1st, a young fellow named Dr. Thomas Waldman walks in through the doors of the National Cancer Institute. What can you remember about your first day here?
I will return to that, but let me give you my perspective of 1956. In 1956 was the last polio epidemic. I was an intern at the Massachusetts General Hospital and was immediately assigned to the polio ward. We had 700 patients, 70 in respirators, in this year, 55-56, before the first widespread use of the polio vaccine. I had in my textbook at that time, in hematology, a discussion of my area of research at the moment. And it said, we have no idea what the role of the lymphocyte is. If you think about it, what did we know then if AIDS had hit at that time? It infects the T lymphocyte, a cell that had not been discovered. It's caused by a retrovirus, HIV, a type of organism that had not been defined. And it enters the cell through a receptor. We knew no receptor whatsoever. So indeed, Much of the advance was contributed by patient-oriented research. That is, research on patients such as in the clinical center, where the doctor and the patient are in the room at the same time in a meaningful encounter. So when I came here as part of the doctor's draft. That is to say, between the Korean and Vietnam War, I came here for 2 years.
I was going to ask about that. You were supposed to be here for a two-year fellowship. Was it the food in the cafeteria that kept you here, or?
It was the ability, in two ways, to say scientifically alive. My total training in research was a $50 grant to study erythropoietin in a little niche of the Harvard Medical School. So all the training that I had, and indeed I soon became the equivalent of a tenured principal investigator, was through the contact in the corridors, in the lunchroom, albeit not for the food, but for the, for the science. The ability to contact others and to learn. And one has here a great number of people that will help you learn how to do things. They won't do your research for you, but they will. The other issue was the clinical center. I cannot emphasize more the importance of the proximity of patients that you can attract from around the world with rare but instructive diseases that you can, for their benefit and for the benefit of those in science, study their them as patients and their disease, taking insights from the patients, questions from the patient, into the wet laboratory where you develop new insights that lead people like myself to make our own drugs, monoclonal antibodies. These are uniform antibodies that we can then use first in animal models and then in patients to treat the patients with disease.
The projects that you're working on now, when you think back for 50 years, does it almost, and I don't want to oversimplify this, and you touched on it earlier, does it almost seem like prehistory now?
Especially in fields like immunology that was not advanced. Cardiology was advanced, endocrinology, but immunology was at its infancy. Questions that could not be asked 50 years ago have been answered definitively for the benefit of our patients.
You didn't even know the questions at that point.
Had no sense of the issues to address now. And this is not only not sensed by the public, but the new scientists that come here feel that anything that's been known for at least 3 years came in with the pyramids.
So in the late 70s, there's a chance discovery that led to some very important breakthroughs in your research and for all of us, really. What can you tell us about that?
A discovery that you might be referring to is the ability to make monoclonal antibodies by Kohler and Milstein. Using cells made by Michael Potter that can make, as a factory, a great number of antibodies that are each identical to the other, which is what you need for a drug.
Mm-hmm.
They discovered this ability. And within a few years, we used this approach to make an antibody to a growth factor receptor. Cells need growth factors to go to receptors on their surface, like a key in a lock,
right,
in order for the cell to divide and mature. And we made an antibody to one of these growth factors. It happens to have the name IL-2, the IL-2 receptor. And what was so important in the intervening years is the resting normal cells of our body do not have this receptor, do not react with our antibody. But abnormal T cells involved in leukemia, involved in autoimmune disease, that is, diseases where T cells attack our body, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, and a blinding disease called uveitis, they have this receptor on the surface of the cells, as do T cells involved in rejecting grafts. So we reasoned that we could use our antibody to eliminate cells we want to get rid of in these diseases without toxicity to the patients. And this indeed turned out to be true.
Okay, here we are 50 years and 1 month and several days into your career here at the NCI. Now, you are certainly somebody, Dr. Thomas Waldman, who could rest on your many laurels. What gets you motivated to get up in the morning, get dressed, fight the rush hour traffic in the Washington, D.C. area, and come to the campus?
I mean, it is the most exciting part of life, more so than even the Redskins winning. And I was a Redskin fan when Sammy Baugh came.
Slinging Sammy Baugh.
To have a problem and resolve it, and especially then to translate that into something that has an impact on human disease. And so initially our antibody was used to prevent the rejection of grafted organs, the kidney, and was approved by the FDA for this purpose. But then we saw that we might treat with collaborators in the clinical center. And I want to emphasize the enormous value of other groups in the clinical center for these studies. So we use this anti-TAC, or diclizumab, its official name, to treat patients with multiple sclerosis, and reduced new episodes of disease by 78%, new attacks on their brain without any toxicity. Uveitis, a blinding disease, we studied in collaboration with Bob Nussenblatt of the Eye Institute, and were able, with administration every 3 weeks indefinitely, to prevent any progression of this disease, that patients could come off all other drug therapy. And so these aspects, using the antibody in new ways, for patients with T-cell malignancy, leukemias and lymphomas, we arm the antibody with a radioisotope and can put a proportion of the patients into long-lasting remission. This includes patients with Hodgkin's disease that have failed all other therapy, where 75% of the patients enter a partial or complete remission with this approach. And there are always the opportunities of seeing things from the clinic you cannot explain. You cannot explain with the prevailing paradigms or ways of thinking. And so with that, as we treated with our antibody, we had such a confusion. And in resolving that confusion, we discovered a new growth factor called IL-50.
Now, you sound to me like somebody who's still very excited about science.
Again, science at the interface, science at the translational level, science where one has basic insights, you make new agents and apply them to the clinic, is unbelievably exciting.
So what would you say to that young scientist walking through the door today for his or her first day at the NCI?
Think in innovative ways, break the paradigm, but do it. Get in there and get your hands dirty. But collaborate with others. Learn from others. Don't be remote. One of the great things about the NIH is the enormity and richness of the number of people here. There are 16,000 people at the NIH, which means that there is someone interested in virtually everything in biomedicine, and you can go to them. And with the web, with the meetings, you will have a chance to talk to them. And again, I found, having been at Harvard and elsewhere, that the doors are more open here than anywhere to conversation.
So nearly 3 months after you began here at the NCI, we look at a date, September 25th, 1956. That was the day that the underwater transatlantic telephone cable was finally opened up for public use. You think of all the science, all the discovery, all the things that we didn't know that are now common knowledge to people, not just in the scientific community, but to folks like me who are laymen and are interested in this topic. It's an honor to sit here with you, Dr. Thomas Waldman, somebody who's had such a large part to play in all this science. Any plans to hang up the lab coat anytime soon?
No, I view science and its contributions like a river, that is, with tributaries, but always moving forward, always building on what has developed in the past, so it gets bigger and bigger. There may be eddies when things are found to be perhaps not the way one perceived it, but it's constantly building. I wish that peace and other things had an inevitable progress. But I think a listing of what we have learned in 50 years is bewildering. And I have had a chance to go back to the World's Fair of New York, where people predicted. And amazingly enough, people do not predict paradigm shifts, or they wouldn't be that. That much of what we are most excited about from were not predicted. A few events, going to the moon, Jules Verne may have envisioned. But so many things are undefined, and there are so many opportunities. As I say, vaccines since Jenner have been unbelievably successful in preventing self-limited diseases like measles or polio, where you have a disease and then are forever okay. The challenge for us immunologists is to get vaccines so that they work for the chronic diseases that escape it. Cancer, AIDS, and I feel that these will not be solved in my lifetime, so there will always be questions, and I'm not going to hang it up.
Dr. Thomas Walden, thank you again so much for your contributions to everything and for your time with us today.
Thank you.
It's a disease you've probably never heard of, and one institute at the NIH wants to change that. Wally Akinso has this report.
Ever hear of celiac disease? Probably not. That's why the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases has launched a campaign to increase awareness of the condition, an autoimmune disorder that interferes with the absorption of nutrients from food. Symptoms of celiac disease range from gas, diarrhea, and abdominal pain to delayed growth, certain skin rashes, infertility, and osteoporosis. Dr. Frank Hamilton, NIDDK's chief of the Digestive Diseases Program in the Division of Digestive Diseases and Nutrition, said the campaign is intended to increase awareness of the disease, resulting in earlier diagnosis and better outcomes.
Well, some of the primary goals is really to change some of the misconceptions about this disease as being an uncommon disease. Based on current evidence, there is 1% or about 3 million Americans are affected with this condition. And our goal is to educate the community, first of all, about what it is and also the prevalence of the disease. Secondly, we want to tell them about ordering the appropriate blood test for patients with celiac disease. And thirdly, to educate the community about the consequences of celiac disease, and hopefully if anything that happens, we can stop the misperception that this is a rare disease, and hopefully patients who have this condition will not suffer because of misdiagnosis.
The campaign offers materials and resources for health professionals and the public about the symptoms, diagnosis, treatment, and management of celiac disease, including fact sheets, booklets, practice tools for health professionals, NIH research information, and resources from professional and voluntary organizations that focus on the disease. For more information about the campaign or to download any of the materials, visit www.celiac.nih.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
And when we return, a report about the development of language and our common monkey ancestor. That's straight ahead on NIH Research Radio. At the NIH, we know there's much to be learned from families, especially where one brother or sister has rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, scleroderma, or myositis, and the other does not. Now, does that sound like your family? Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116. If you're eligible, study-related tests are free. You'll be compensated for your time, and transportation may be reimbursed. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency and part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. What do these sounds mean to you? Nothing, right? Well, that's because you're not a rhesus monkey. If you were a rhesus monkey, those sounds would mean a great deal to you. How rhesus macaque monkeys process those sounds to discern their meaning may lead scientists to an understanding of the point in the evolutionary timeline when the building blocks of language first appeared in human development. According to research conducted by scientists at the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders and the National Institute of Mental Health, the parts of the brain the rhesus monkey uses to make sense of the sounds you just heard correspond to the two principal language centers of the human brain. Scientists say this advances the theory that a shared ancestor to humans and present-day non-human primates may have possessed the key neural mechanisms on which language was built. Now, monkeys are not capable of language in any real sense of the word, according to Dr. Alan Braun, chief of NIDCD's language section.
But they are capable of processing meaning that's encoded in an acoustic signal, which is the case with their calls. And the areas of the brain that are involved in processing that meaning are areas that we think eventually became bootstrapped to process these combinatorial features of language in humans.
To measure the brain activity of monkeys as they tried to make sense of various sounds, brain scans were done as they listened to three types of sounds: the recorded coos and screams of other rhesus monkeys, as well as other assorted non-biological sounds, according to Dr. Ricardo Gil da Costa of the Gulbenkian Science Institute in Portugal, who conducted the study during a three-year joint appointment at the NIDCD and NIMH.
What we did was building up a set of non-biological sounds that included a lot of different things, from modern human environment like telephones ringing, doors closing, etc., to natural sounds like rain, water flowing, that kind of things, to computer synthesized noise. Now what we tried was to make this set of non-biological sounds as broad as possible in a way, and the other way, make sure that we'd include most of the bioacoustic features that are present in both coos and screams separately.
Based on these findings, scientists suggest that the communication centers in the brain of the last common ancestor of humans and rhesus monkeys, particularly those parts of the brain used for interpreting species-specific vocalizations, may have been recruited during the evolution of language in humans. In the light of an earlier study from the same group, which showed that these kind of monkey calls activated brain regions that process high-order visual and emotional information, researchers suggest the language areas of the brain may have evolved from a much larger system used to extract meaning from socially relevant situations, a system in which humans and non-human primates might share similar neural pathways. Further studies will look into which regions of the non-human primate brain are activated when animals listen to other meaningful sounds, such as predator calls, sounds made by humans, or other relevant environmental noises. In addition, scientists will study the pattern of brain activation caused by non-auditory stimuli, such as visual images of monkeys producing visualizations. What's being done to lower the incidence in HIV/AIDS infection among Hispanic youths? Matt Thornton has the story.
HIV infection in the Hispanic community remains a serious problem, even more so among adolescents. According to the National Institute of Nursing Research at the National Institutes of Health, HIV and AIDS have a disproportionate effect on Hispanic adolescents, with the incidence of AIDS for Hispanic youth and adults triple that of their non-Hispanic white counterparts. One reason for this may be highlighted in a National Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance System, which found that Hispanic youths are having more sex before the age of 13 and with multiple sex partners at a higher rate than black or white adolescents. But there are ways to combat this trend. A study funded by the NINR shows that Hispanic teens who took part in a culturally tailored HIV risk reduction program were less likely to engage in risky sexual practices that can lead to HIV infection compared to their counterparts who took part in a general health promotion program. The program is called Cuidate, which means take care of yourself. NINR Director Dr. Patricia A. Grady talked about the program's success.
The program was found to be successful in increasing awareness of sexual practices and increasing the safety of sexual practices in teenagers. In fact, it was found in the study group that they had a decrease in sexual activity, sexual intercourse, a decrease in multiple partners, and an increase in safe sex practices when they did engage in intercourse. So the long-term outcome one expects with an intervention such as this is it will prevent the transmission of HIV/AIDS.
The Center for Disease Control and Prevention said in 2001 that HIV infection was the fourth leading cause of death in Hispanics aged 25 to 44. The results of this study suggest that there is a benefit to providing education on both abstinence and safe sex practices. The results can be found in the August issue of Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine. From the National Institutes of Health, I'm Matt Thornton in Bethesda, Maryland.
And finally, here's Wally Akinsa with yet another reason for young mothers and mothers-to-be to consider giving up smoking.
It's well known that a mother who smokes during her pregnancy is putting her child's health at risk. Now, a study supported by the National Institute on Drug Abuse suggests that's just the tip of the iceberg. The findings from the study indicate that children whose mothers smoke during pregnancy begin to show a pattern of behavior problems as early as 18 to 24 months of age. It is the first study to show a link between smoking during pregnancy and child behavior problems in the first years of life. Dr. Nora Volkoff, NIDA director, said this study tells researchers and scientists to take a closer look at how smoking during pregnancy affects a baby's development and behavior.
What's really important in this study is that it can document so early on in the development significant differences by the fact of just exposure to nicotine during pregnancy. And this study then does highlight the relevance, the deleterious effects that exposure to nicotine may have to the developing brain, which is something that we know is important because studies have shown a wider range for a wide variety of neuropsychiatric diseases in these children, but it's something that we haven't paid sufficient attention.
Researchers also found that exposure to cigarette smoke was associated with disruptive social behavior in children. Dr. Volkoff said this study highlights the importance of better understanding how prenatal exposure to nicotine affects the development of the fetal brain and how in turn this can disrupt behavior later on in childhood and adolescence.
Basically, in the study, it was only children that have, in this cohort, of those children that have behavioral problems, all of them had come from the group whose mothers had been smoking cigarettes, clearly providing the importance of instituting preventive measures to really get women to stop smoking during pregnancy.
Dr. Volkoff said this study does not prove prenatal exposure to cigarettes causes behavior problems, but it does bring scientists closer to understanding how that exposure affects fetal brain systems that regulate behavior. This is Wally Akinsa at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
And with that, we come to the end of another edition of NIH Research Radio. Please join us Friday, August 25th, when episode 13 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the HealthStar Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info is right there on the podcast webpage. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfelt. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, a proud part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.